The first reading this morning comes from the amazing writings of a Reformation-era genius, now almost completely forgotten. His name was Sebastian Castellio. His books on reason and his critique of both Swiss reformer John Calvin's theology and actions can dazzle even modern minds. The reading comes from two sources. First, from his four dialogues written in 1578. And here he was commenting on the terrible cruelty of John Calvin in burning Miguel Serveto as a heretic just because he questioned the then 1,100-year-old doctrine of the Trinity. Here's the reading. I'm going to read it twice. To burn someone is not to protect a doctrine, it is to kill someone. To burn someone is not to protect a doctrine, it is to kill someone. Secondly, in his On the Art of Doubting and Believing, a Knowing and Not Knowing, written in 1563, but published only after his death, he wrote, because sacred writings are obscure in controversial matters and often give probable support to both sides, it has proved impossible down the ages to put an end to dispute merely by quoting scripture. Hence, it is necessary to see something in which truth is made so clear and universally acknowledged that it cannot be destroyed by any force or even any probability that suggests the contrary. What is this agent of truth I am talking about? It is our sensory experience and reflective understanding. The Latin is sensus ut intellectum. Since these are the source of our judgments in everyday life, there should be little doubt as to their reliability. But there are those who want us to believe with our eyes closed and to put our trust in things which contradict our experience. They are impertinent to try and persuade us to put aside our own judgment of the matter and accept their own, as if we could not see, and they can, and that we should follow them regardless of the pits of absurdity into which they stumble. The second is from my dear colleague, Joy Atkinson, who lives out in California and has been doing interim ministries now for 20 years. This is her Womb of the Stars, first published in 1992.
The womb of stars embraces us. Remnants of their fiery furnaces pulse through our veins. We are of the stars, the dust of explosions cast across space. We are of the earth. We breathe and live in the breath of ancient plants and beasts. Their cells nourish the soil. We build our communities on their harvest of gifts. Our fingers trace the curves carved in clay and stone by forebears unknown to us. We are part of the great circle of humanity, gathered around the fire, the hearth, the altar. We gather anew this day to celebrate our common heritage. May we recall in gratitude all that has given us birth. Thank you.
So most every morning, except on Sundays because I'm here, I go to have my social cup of coffee at One Line Coffee on High Street in the Short North. They have most excellent fair trade brews from specific estates around the world, all of which one of the owners, David, has visited. The baristas, or the coffee makers there, are quite remarkable. Mick, who supervises the place, told me he understands himself as the spiritual leader of the staff. And indeed, the feeling of warm friendship between the people behind the cafe counter, with each other and with those who just come in to get their morning cup, is vivid and welcoming, and I love going there. On Friday this week, I was talking with Nate, one of the baristas. Somehow we got to talking about our travels, our trips to Mexico in particular. He told me of his time learning Spanish in Cuernavaca, and we compared our visits to Mexico City, specifically the neighborhood called the Zona Rosa. Eventually, he started saying some things which helped me to reflect on what I'm going to talk about this morning. And I will use that part of our conversation to conclude my words later on. Each of us in this room, I think it's safe to say, grew up in different cultures and in different families and in different traditions, maybe different geographies too. We may use the same words sometimes, but have a totally different history with those words. Take the word secular, for example. Today, there are folks who describe themselves as secular humanists, both in the world outside these walls and within these walls, in this congregation. I suppose most of us have some idea of what that phrase means. But I grew up, way back in the 50s, with a different understanding of the word secular. I heard the word secular every single day in its original Latin form, because I went to a Roman Catholic grammar school before the Latin language was deposed from the Mass, and we went to Mass every day. And several times each day in the morning service, which we were required to attend, the priest would say or chant, "Per omnia saecula saeculorum," which literally means, "in all of the centuries of centuries," because the word "saecula" just means that. It means century, 100 years. And so in all the centuries of centuries, you find a colloquial Latin phrase, which simply means a really long time. And that same basic Latin word was used in its English form, too, when I was a child. The priests in the church of my parish were called secular priests, which only meant that they were not part of some order like the Franciscans or the Dominicans or the Jesuits. They were secular priests. But over the centuries, the Latin word saecula, meaning just century, came to refer to something else. It came to refer to the difference between religiously ruled nations and nations that chose to remove clergy from political influence and replace them with people who were working on the issues of this world, not the next world. It didn't mean that a person in government had to avoid religious activities personally, for the most part. Only that theology was not to be the main focus of national governance. People's ordinary daily lives in this life, in the present world, were to be the focus. Because of this, quite a few self-anointed fundamentalist or conservative religious authorities in our day have declared that secularity is a heresy. Heresy. Another ancient word. This time from the Greek, not the Latin. Aeresis is the Greek, and it means simply this: choice. That which is chosen. That's all, choice. But obviously, if my choice for coffee in the morning at one line is to take the one grown in Honduras and not the one grown in Mexico, there is nobody in the wings with a pile of wood and a match ready to burn me alive at the stake because I've made that choice. That is because, like everything else I can think of, meanings always change over the centuries, over the secula seculorum. And heresy came to mean something more serious than which coffee a person chooses to drink. It meant, according to those who use the word heresy, stubborn nonconformity, a deliberate choice for the decidedly wrong party or the decidedly wrong theology. And people took these intellectual choices so seriously, they killed people just because they dared to decide for themselves what was right for them. The 16th century man, whose writings you heard this morning, Sebastian Castellio, actually saw a group of people killed for heresy with his own eyes. He saw a whole group of people who believed differently than the majority or the authorities burned alive at the stake. This event, this experience, sickened him to the core of his being. I think you can guess that that would happen to any of us. He had hoped, after seeing this, that the Protestant Revolution in Europe would change all that. The famous reformer John Calvin of Geneva even became his friend after a while because he had written when he was younger that people needed to be able to think and question freely in matters of religion. However, as more and more power fell into Calvin's hands, his theology changed. So that when a physician, who also happened to be a theologian, Miguel Serveto of Zaragoza in Spain, boldly questioned the central Christian doctrine of the Trinity, Calvin threatened to kill him verbally. Wait till I get my hands on you. And when he actually got his hands on him, which did happen, he did exactly what he promised. He burned him alive at the stake outside the walls of Geneva. When Castellio heard what his friend had done, he was horrified in the extreme. He sat down and he wrote a book under a false name, just to be safe, criticizing Calvin boldly and very cleanly. As you heard this morning, he wrote, "To burn someone is not to protect a doctrine, it is to kill someone." Those words offer one of the truly most profound insights of that whole Reformation era. And those particular words planted the seed for the Enlightenment 200 years later. Castellio was saying, let's look at this in a secular, not a theological way. A theological idea is just that, an idea. A living human body is just that, a living human body. To kill a body is not to kill an idea. It's to murder somebody. In the next passage you heard this morning, Castellio attempts to split truth off from authority. Things are not true, he was saying, just because you say they're true. I have a capacity to understand things myself. I can read. I can experience the world too. I have experiences. If I choose to regard my own experience as the source of my truth, you can have no claim over me. Or putting it better, maybe in the concise phrase of the radical Quaker genius Lucretia Mott from this country, several centuries later, truth for authority, not authority for truth. A great motto. Sadly, Calvin, a true scoundrel, paid no attention to his former friend's criticism, but did everything he could in his power, and he had plenty of it, to keep Castellio and his wife and children, his family, in poverty until the end of his life. And sadly, Serveto was not the last heretic to burn in the fire. When a non-secular priest, a Dominican monk named Giordano Bruno, publicly asserted things that today sound like astronomy and not theology, he was also burned alive at the stake in the Campo de Fiori in Rome. All he had said was that the universe is impossibly vast, and that the many stars that make up our universe are also suns like our own, and that around those other suns undoubtedly whirl planets, something like the Earth, and that on those other planets perhaps life exists like our own. For this they burned him. Of course, the late and great polymath Isaac Asimov made patently clear that heresy is not just a religious term. Even in the world of secular science, there are heretics. Stakes and fire don't greet them nowadays, assuredly, but they still spark hot outrage. I think of folks like Emmanuel Velikovsky. Many of you maybe have never heard of him, but he wrote that the planet Venus was ejected from the planet Jupiter only a few thousand years ago, and this caused many astronomers to actually steam at the ears. They were so angry that he said this, and that his books were selling like hotcakes, and that theirs weren't. And even more infamously, Eric von Däniken, a Swiss author who wrote Chariots of the Gods and many other books, and who spent years in prison for fraud as he was writing these books, tried to reinterpret every single archaeological and historical understanding of the last 100 years by saying that alien beings from other planets, the ones which Bruno thought might be there, were involved in every single aspect of human history because human beings are mere fools who can't do anything for themselves. Every single thing he has asserted in every single one of his books has been soundly and totally disproved by actual astronomers and archaeologists. And yet his books still sell by the millions. Bruno was right about the universe's size. About life out there, we're still waiting. But von Däniken has proven to be wrong on every single account, no exceptions. So has Velikovsky. But in modern times, because the killing of people whose choices are novel and unorthodox has faded here in the West, the story of Bruno provides the original example of how heresy often over time turns out to be the actual truth. For example, when Georges Lemaître, a secular priest who taught physics at the University of Louvain, first suggested that the universe started from an extremely small first atom or cosmic egg, he was criticized by almost everyone at first. Even the usually very gentle Albert Einstein scolded him. "I can't argue with your calculations, but your physics is terrible." And astronomer Fred Hoyle, who had been teaching that the universe had always existed and always will exist, and that there was no explosion that caused everything, but everything was in a steady state without any explosion at the beginning at all, made fun of Lemaître's idea on a radio show one day by satirically renaming it the Big Bang. Strangely, it's that word which is still used today, not cosmic egg, perhaps because such a poetic term echoes all of those mythical creation tales I mentioned earlier when our children were here. Nor was Lemaître's first term, the first atom, used, because I think that's confusing, since everything we are taught in school is made of atoms, and so it's just strange. There's a first atom and then all the rest. So Hoyle's Big Bang insult stuck as the name for Lemaître's idea. Yet today, despite Hoyle's criticism leveled against the very idea of a universe expanding because it exploded originally, the Big Bang idea of this Belgian secular priest is almost universally accepted. Hoyle himself went to his deathbed repudiating it. He died in 2001. But that seems like it was more stubbornness than scientific evidence being offered. Hoyle also suggested, quite crankily, that the only reason that the Big Bang theory later made sense to all the rest of the cosmologists is that they were all in the thrall of the book of Genesis. They had all been raised in churches with the Bible, and they just couldn't shake themselves free of it. He was suspicious that they were trying to sneak God in by the back door, and as an atheist, he made clear he would have none of it. His theory about whether religious people can be scientists or not proved to be completely false, at least in the case of Lemaître. Because when the Pope in that day tried to publicly suggest, and he did, that Lemaître's cosmic egg theory was somehow a proof of God, Lemaître not only publicly repudiated the Pope, but actually privately repudiated him too, and got him to stop asserting such a fool thing as a proof of God. No easy political task, I assure you right now. But now, George Lemaître's heresy is everywhere the accepted idea about how things came to be. Hoyle's mocking term has even made it into a television show that everyone seems to like to watch, The Big Bang Theory. More to the point, writings like Joy Atkinson, rooted in Lemaître's theory, are used in churches and synagogues now, offering people an invitation to feel what Einstein called the feeling of the mysterious. The womb of the stars embraces us, she writes. Remnants of the fiery furnaces pulse through our veins. We are of the stars, the dust of explosions cast across space. Lovely words. For many these days, the origin story of the cosmos supplants all the earlier ones that came before, the ones you heard earlier. But strangely, it does echo them, didn't it? The cosmic egg was an old term, and it was used by many cultures. And I have to agree completely with Carl Sagan, who in his very trenchant criticism of von Däniken proclaimed that the ancients, our ancestors, were simply not dummies. Heresy choice was once fraught with fear and death. Think and say the wrong thing, die a cruel death. But in our day, in our own secular world, with the stakes left aside, what we choose, as an old Unitarian hymn puts it, is what we are. What we choose is what we are. Our choices, our heresies, if you will, are what define us and help shape our identity. And once again, I'm not talking here about the simple heresies, the simple choices, like whether to drink Honduran or Mexican coffee on a morning, I'm talking about the deeper choices, reflecting the deeper questions, like, how do I want to live my life? Who decides how I live my life? Other people? How do I know how to live? Because of various orthodoxies, both secular and religious? Tell me how to live? Because I uncritically accept assumptions made all around me as fact? And this is where I have to return back to Nate, my articulate barista at One Line Coffee. As I was talking with him that day, I heard a person living his life by his own thoughtfully chosen choices, listening to the music he likes, even though it's not current, wearing the clothes he likes, even though they are quite dated, making choices about the meaning of his life spiritually that he confidently owns, because he, like Castellio suggested, uses his understanding and his experience to frame his life, not authorities outside of him. As we talked the other day, I also realized that Nate is a refreshingly clear heretic, that is, a person of decision and choice, because he sees his choices through the lens of gratitude, not complaint. He is glad to be who he is. He does not want to be anyone else. He is thankful that he was raised by parents who cared about him. He doesn't fall for the consumerist type of our age that you have to buy more in order to be someone. He is thoughtfully aware of all the privileges and gifts that he has, and yet he does not complain that he does not have other gifts and privileges. He has chosen to find happiness not in striving, but in becoming, not in trying to be perfect according to someone else's chart, but to actually live his life without comparing himself to anybody positively or negatively. Nate kept on using the word choice as we talked. I chose this way. I chose the other way. And finally, I mentioned that to him, and I told him it kept me thinking about what I was going to say this morning, knowing that heresy meant choice. And after all the history and the stories and the myths and the science, I have to come back to something very simple and personal in regard to our whole Unitarian Universalist tradition over all the years, over the secula seculorum, the very long time, emblazoned, as you heard, with the life and the death of heretics. Namely, I conclude that we are here to lift up a vision of the world where everyone, regardless of things like gender and ethnic background and differing abilities and health and sexual orientation and economic status, can live out their deep hopes and visions as they choose after thoughtful reflection on their own experiences. The reason that we speak so much about the word justice around here has to do exactly with that. Because we know, as Nate articulated to me, that there are those who do not have the privileges that he has. And we know there are people who don't have the privileges we have. People for whom the whole idea of choice, heresy, is still a terrifying barrier to a free and decisive life. Our historic heresy, expressed throughout the centuries in various ways, is that no one should be cut off from the privilege of living an honest, healthy life where we decide for ourselves. This heresy, this idea, this proclamation, this faith, is our mission for ourselves and for the world outside these walls.